Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Again, this weekend's edition, we are going to be focusing on the resource sector, commodities broadly driving down into the stocks because, well, we're still in a very good environment for these commodity stocks, and we're continuing to see money broadly come into the sector as well as some financing news and other M&A activity. I think it's all positive for us investors that have been in these sectors waiting for these breakouts to happen. Now they're all happening. So in the first half of this show, we're going to chat with Joe Mazumdar, talking more about the resource sector, more of the metals area. And in the second half of the show, switching over to the energy sector with Dan Steffens, and a big focus there on natural gas's recent move higher. Now, Joe Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. Joe, it's always interesting hearing what you're seeing in the market. And quite frankly, look, we have silver above $30, gold right around $2,400 as we're recording this. Copper was just above $5. It has pulled back a little bit as we're recording this on Wednesday. But overall, strong metals prices. Investors are starting to take notice. Joe, where do you see some of the best opportunities in the stocks, the underlying equities, understanding that for these main metals that I just talked about, precious metals and copper being the base metal, this is a move that's still pretty early on, only about 3 months long for the precious metals. Where are the best opportunities out there?
Well, interestingly, we were seeing moves, and for me, the best indication that we would be in this environment several months ago, the leading indicator for me was the M&A that we were seeing. Like the M&A that we were seeing in 2023, some of it was transactional, companies getting together as major shareholders in both companies sought to reduce their G&A spends and just say, well, here, you guys get the same amount of money, cut management, and just prioritize the assets that you guys have combined. And those sort of transactions didn't make any money for any shareholder, but it gained them a bit of liquidity, prioritized assets, and more importantly, combined working capital. So even though there was that a bit of M&A, that kind of M&A really is not a good indicator of anything more than desperate times. But now we're seeing more M&A towards the latter part of the last year and this year with multiple bids and actual premiums where shareholders are actually making money. So on a positive note, we saw Osino, and that was approved by the Canadian government, and that acquisition by a state-owned Chinese company went through. We saw the Greenstone bidding for the 40% ownership of Orion Finance Group of the Greenstone mine, and that was multiple bid because Gold Road was also interested. So those sort of multiple bids that we're seeing are really positive for me in terms of knowing that the industry is seeing the lack of assets out there. People need to fill their portfolio. People want exposure to rising metal prices. And that really was a good signal of what we're seeing right now, and both in copper, gold, and now in silver.
Yeah, Joe, it's nice to see the animal spirits coming back to the space. And in addition to the ones you mentioned, there was also both Silvercorp and Perseus going after OreCorp, where you had a bidding war there. And then when Silvercorp didn't win because Perseus got the deal, they went and acquired Adventus Mining. And then you just saw G Mining take over Reunion Gold. So there's a lot of positive momentum going where investors are actually it's freeing up some capital to rotate around the sector, but it's some investors are actually making money on these premiums finally. So instead of take-unders, we're finally seeing some takeovers. Do you think that will get more of a speculation into the development stage companies that have big assets? They've got maybe some economic studies in place. Do you think we'll see some of those finally start getting traction with investors as they could be the potential next takeover candidates?
Yes, because if we see your Adventus, advanced stage, base metal, copper dominant, volcanogenic massive sulfide in Ecuador being taken out, and then the other one you were talking about was Reunion Gold. That's advanced exploration, not quite development in Guyana. as well being taken out. So now we're seeing that sort of development, but we're not seeing it like a Sabena-like acquisition where shareholders are flat in terms of a return, 30% premium, if that, to a 52-week low. We're seeing a premium on top of sometimes 52-week highs. So that's the kind of things we want to see. Thankfully, we're seeing that now.
Joe, what kind of assets do you think are next on the table for M&A then? These do seem to be more advanced assets. Anything on your radar, either jurisdictionally wise or actual project wise?
So in terms of high risk, high reward, exploration is now looking much better because I'm seeing a lot more financings. And they're coming almost every week now. But when I was seeing financings previously, the problem was with a lot of these financing transactions coming off of 52-week lows, they had to offer also long-dated warrants, not much of a premium to the unit. So even though they could fund and there was money out there, the money really was ripping into the share structure of the company going forward. If you already own the share, it wasn't a great transaction. If you were coming in on that transaction and rising prices, it was a good transaction for you to come in on, but it wasn't a great one for the people that were already in. I think going forward, we might see better transactions in terms of the equity space. Right now, I prefer just to buy in the market. I don't have the four-month hold. I'm not that keen on the warrant. And for me, the companies that don't have to issue these warrants and don't have to issue them at a small premium with a long dated warrant, that sort of indicates to me that it's a better asset as well.
Well, I'm just thinking of the capital markets, having a little bit of a capital window here to raise funds for some companies. There's a lot of companies that already luckily cashed up ahead of time, or maybe they had 2 or 3 years of money raised, so they were able to do some drilling this year. But we've noticed a general trend of a lot of companies being really late to the game this year, or not even having a work program yet because they haven't raised, or the ones that have raised taking a more tentative stance and saying, hey, instead of doing 20 or 30,000 meters of drilling, we're going to do 10,000. Or instead of 10,000, we're going to do 5,000. And we're not going to try to do resource drilling. We're going to try to go make a new discovery. Do you think some of the companies are, I don't want to say it, but maybe a contrary indicator that now that the metals prices are breaking out and now that investors are coming back, they finally decided to be more shrewd in their capital and they blew a lot of money when nobody was watching? Do you think that maybe it's actually a good counter indicator?
Yeah, I don't know. These guys are driven by the people that give them money. And so the people that give them money say, oh, I like this one. Why don't we drill that? Because that's what I'm interested in. And so if you're given 2, 5 million, whatever, you're going to focus in on what those people that gave you the money are focused in on. If you got weak hands, where I see strong hands is that they've got a program. They know what they're doing. They're selling that program. They're selling their assets to these potential investors. And that's what they're buying into. They're buying into management. They're buying into the asset. They're buying into this news flow. Other people have assets, but then the people that are giving them money would like them to do something specific. And they'll just take whatever money they can get. Just because, like you said, you know, during PDAC, when people usually tend to raise money, there wasn't a lot of money raised then. And as we get closer to the North American field season, especially in Canada and the northern parts of Canada, these guys are desperate to raise money because they want to get the rig. They want to put the drill contract out. They want to get their people in the field. And some people haven't even hired people for the field season. And once somebody comes in and hires them, then if you're really late to the financing window, there might not be many people for the field season to help you. And also, you might get the worst drill contractor.
All right, Joe, that's all the time we have for this segment. But we're having you back on next segment. So everyone stick around. We're going to be right back with Joe Mazumdar, continuing to focus on resource stocks. Because, hey, we're all invested in them. Let's find which ones have the best opportunities. Yeah, it's so interesting just to see how slow a lot of these companies are. But hey, that's what a 4-year bear market does when money is tight and they weren't getting any value for the work they were doing. Tying that into ounces in the ground value. Boy, oh boy, we saw a depressed price for a lot of the ounces in the ground. Now, an argument being there's a lot more ounces in the ground, so that money can spread out a little bit more across all these different assets. But we have seen generally a revaluation here Joe, what do you do when you're looking at these resources? And you obviously hear from companies these comparison slides saying, look what these companies are valued at and their ounces in the ground. Look what we're valued at, obviously lower, and our ounces in the ground. How do you compare ounces in the ground and how much they should be valued for?
Well, if we take, let's say, a feasibility study that just came out from a company in northern Quebec and a very low grade gold and sort of, I don't even want to call it a copper asset because the grade was like 0.06%. They came out with their feasibility study and they were duly punished by the market, even in a rising gold environment. Why? Because their return was low and the capital ran up quite a bit, partly because their last study was during COVID and they increased their throughput capacity quite a bit. So those kind of low economic return projects are still getting punished in the market. So you really, when you look at EV per ounce, or if that's a metric you're looking at, if you see the asset and see that the potential to develop something economic that somebody might be interested in, meaning a suitor, is low, that EV per ounce calculation might just stay the same. It's better probably to put your money into the ones that are a little bit more valuable, because in a good market, those would still be the ones that have the have less downside risk, even because we know markets are volatile. There's not a lot of suitors out there because of the consolidation we've had. So you want to get the ones that have probably a higher probability of getting acquired.
Well, let's also talk about potential red flags for ones that you think actually won't get acquired, because there's a lot of companies that have ounces in the ground, millions and many times in gold, or sometimes hundreds of millions in silver, and they've been on the sales rack since the last cycle, and nobody's taken them up on it. And so a lot of these companies will flag that, hey, we have all these ounces in the ground and we should be revalued higher. But they're really faced with the decision of, can I raise the money and build this thing, or will somebody please take us out? And a lot of them can't raise the money, so they're perpetually waiting for a takeout. What are some of the red flags you look for, Joe, having spent time in the industry, working with majors, looking at acquisitions? What would cause you to say no to a project if you're in that role?
Well, how quickly could you permit it? You know, what would be the upfront capital? Red flags, the metallurgy is difficult. We don't do that kind of metallurgical process. The footprint is so big, we might have problems with either the First Nations or a local community, those social license to operate issues. Let's take something like Casino. Like their Rio Tinto put a footprint into Western copper and gold. The grade is not great. It's a semi-remote project, and it requires a lot of capital, more than $2 billion probably in the end, Canadian. But they're doing LNG because obviously the Yukon, that part of the Yukon or any part of the Yukon, doesn't have any power. So what Rio Tinto seems to want is for that project to be green. And so they're willing to hang on to this project that's low grade, but potentially for the opportunity in the long run to get connected to the BC grid. But connection to the BC grid would require about $1.7 billion. So I don't know how that's going to happen or when that's going to happen. But you do that option because you probably think that, oh, here's a project in the Yukon that I can get permitted. So the jurisdiction's good. I'm okay with the grade in a rising copper and gold environment, but I'd really like to get green copper. So what's that going to take? Each one can have a different slant in terms of why you're acquiring it. You might acquire a project because you have a plant and you might need more feed. You might acquire a project because you already operate it and you want a higher ownership. That would be Equinox and the Orion transaction. When I was with Newmont, we did a similar thing with, I think it was AngloGold Ashanti at the time, owned the other third of Boddington. And so we acquired that to get full ownership of Boddington. Those are some of the easiest transactions to do because the due diligence you don't have to really do because you're already the operator. You already understand the deposit. You already understand the financial metrics. All you're doing is acquiring the other piece. So the ability to do that transaction is very quick, and the ability to know to integrate the transaction, which sometimes takes a long time, would be very quick. So every transaction is a bit different. And like I said, on the demand side, we've got less suitors. So we're even more suitor specific in terms of what are these suitors looking for.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Less suitors out there. But hey, Joe, I want to switch focus just a little bit and talk about silver, because silver has broken out above $30 an ounce. And we all know how much speculation can come into silver, as well as the silver stocks. A number of the silver primary miners, they should be making money now when they were dealing with all-in sustaining costs of over $20 an ounce. Are you enticed at all to get into the silver focus, silver specific stocks?
Well, I went into a silver advanced explorer in Northwest Argentina, in a place where I've worked previously in the 90s. So I'm familiar with the jurisdiction. I'm going to visit it in June. And that's got a resource, that's got a higher market cap. Like, it's not a 20 million, 30 million, it's more like 200 million. But with that, there's a resource there. They have, it's silver dominant, so it's not like it's a 30% silver, and it's in a place where you can get permitted. So those are the sort of things I'm looking for in the silver space. But also in the silver space, I do have royalties, smaller royalty companies with silver exposure. And so that's another way I'm playing this, as opposed to playing the producer all the time. I'm looking at these smaller royalty companies that have more leverage, that have exposure to the silver, copper, gold trifecta. And so that's another way I'm playing this.
That's an interesting point on the royalty companies. We don't really give it enough airtime as far as ways to play things like copper or silver, not just gold. And some of them are more diversified. And if you dig into their assets and what they actually have royalties on, some of it is coming off of silver or copper and not just gold. But it's a great way to play the space. A lot of people would say, well, Joe, there's not much leverage in a royalty company. But in some of the price spikes that we've seen, like in 2016 or even in the 2020 and 2019 to 2020 run, some of the royalty companies, the smaller ones, did quite well, as did the large ones. What would you say to people that say, oh, I don't want a position in royalty companies because there's not as much upside?
I'll give them an example. Origin, I took a position when they fell based on the quality drilling that obviously was very negative, and they went from, I don't know, they were up to a buck 50 at that point, and they fell back down to below 30 cents. I was about to sell them, but then I saw that level at 30 cents, and I thought, well, this is fairly valued here because they have this royalty that's not producing yet, this 2% NSR on the Ermitaño project with First Majestic. And I've held that company for 5 years or more. In the portfolio, we have one position, I think, that's almost 10 years. I really like the management team, and they did make an acquisition, the Renaissance Gold acquisition, which gave them a 1% NSR royalty on the Silicon project. The Silicon Merlin project went from zero in terms of ounces to 13 million ounces. That stock has gone from that 30 cents to hitting a new high of about a buck 25. They never changed their share structure. They never had to go to the market. Why? Because they had that other 2% NSR on Ermitaño. So they had cash flow coming in. So when everybody saw that, oh, look at how Silicon's going bigger, oh, well, these guys are going to go to the markets. Well, why do they have to go to the markets? One is that they make money off of their prospect generation business. Two, they get cash inflow from their 2% paying royalty. Three, they don't have to spend a cent on drilling anything to grow a resource from zero to 13 to 14 million ounces. And right now, the price of drilling a meter in Nevada is like 450 to 500 bucks a meter US. So imagine that. Imagine if you found something, then the next thing you would have to do is go back to the market to raise this kind of cash to drill it. But imagine a company that doesn't have to do that.
Yeah, well, it's one of the benefits of the royalty model, right? Is that they are not so cash intensive and cash, they don't need to keep outlaying a bunch of cash. But Joe, look, there's a lot more small royalty companies out there, and all these small royalty companies have, let's say, a handful, maybe a dozen at most royalties that pay them money. They really don't make huge amounts of revenue, maybe $10 million a year, but many of them are even under that figure. But they have a lot of these development or exploration assets in their portfolio. How do you filter through and do your due diligence on these companies? Obviously, paying some attention to the assets that are cash flowing right now, but analyzing all these other assets in their portfolio that these companies always say they'll give us value, but we just don't know the timing.
Yeah, I would not, like anything, just pick a sector, whether it's exploration, development, advanced exploration, or production, and just say, oh, just stick to this sector and buy everything in here. You're going to have to filter. And if you want to filter on the basis of finding something like Origin, primary is management, and management filters what assets they purchase and their own dilution. And Origin's management has been excellent in doing that. So that's what you want to prioritize, and their ability to filter and acquire, and then also not spend a lot of money. So they've gone from trying to do these joint ventures where they end up with 30% of the asset and the other company owns 30, and then they have to buck up money in a joint venture. They don't do that anymore because there's this argument. Well, don't you want to own 30% of the asset? No, you don't, because in the end, that NSR, that 2%, ends up being worth more in the current markets than your equity stake, because everybody's waiting for you to go to the markets to pay your part of the joint venture. Better to rest on your laurels, keep the 2% NSR, and then go on to the next one. And then focus your G&A and your management's time and simply always acquiring the next high quality royalty. And also have a team there that's doing royalty generation. And they've been generating new royalties or by acquiring ground with Altius in the Walker Lane belt. And now with the uptick in the market, other companies are raising money to explore their ground, and they retain their 2% NSR. The good thing would be that they do find something, and then a bigger company comes in and develops a project. But look, they've still got the 2% NSR, and it's even more valuable now because a big company is actually operating it. And that's why the Silicon project makes so much sense, is because the final developer of that project is the company that owns it right now.
Just a follow-up on the Silicon deposit and the Merlin deposit that AngloGold Ashanti has. If you think about that Walker Lane trend in Nevada, it's very prolific. But when they made that discovery, and to some degree Corvus with that Lindis Strip, where they had a similar kind of mineralogy, it changed the way people looked at, where to go look for gold in Nevada in that particular area. And you had the Sterling deposit that Coeur Mining had, which was previously held by Northern Empire, and they eventually acquired that too. And now we see things like Scorpio Gold going possibly back into development and then eventually production. Does a new discovery like that of size, like what AngloGold Ashanti has, change the way all the exploration companies view that area as possibly a new area play?
Absolutely. So Walker Lane has, well-trodden, let's say, area. But when you make a new discovery in a place that has been walked over, it always excites people, because when they see probably one of the biggest gold discoveries that's happened over the last past few decades, this is huge. And it's still not been bounded in terms of size, because they have a bigger land package and there's other targets that they still have to drill. Because when we looked at it first, I didn't think it was more than 3 to 5 million ounces, and most of it was silicon. Merlin has ended up being bigger than silicon. So you have a little bit of the Kamoa-Kakula thing going, where Kamoa was the big deposit that Ivanhoe had, and suddenly they did some drilling and then Kakula ended up being better. That's exactly what happened here with Merlin and silicon. And so that excites the entire area. And so if you're a junior explorer going, to the markets and saying, oh, I want to go raise money. Why are you raising money? Oh, I'm going to raise it to find another ratty, marginal, supposed high-grade deposit that never makes anybody any money. It's very low tonnage and not very hard to find the grade here. Or you can say, I'm going to go look for something like these guys have found that's almost 15 million ounces. Well, that excites people more, and that you can get money to do that. And so for them, it's about selling the story. And now they have a better story to sell to get money for their. And then they can have a geological model and say, look, we're in the same caldera setting. We're in the same sort of units. We've got similar looking structures, and we're going to drill those. And they use this kind of geophysical method, and they got these kind of anomalies, and we see the same sort of thing. And so people will give you that money for that analog, knowing that the potential reward is huge.
All right, Joe, thank you so much for your time. It's great having you on the show, especially in an environment like this where markets, the metals, the commodities broadly are running higher and the stocks are also taking notice. Now, again, these stocks, a number of them in the ETFs are well off their highs as these metals are breaking out, some of them to all-time highs. So I think we're just all still hoping and watching the money continue to flow into these stocks and push them higher as interest continues to grow. Now a lot of these companies have money, so let's see what they do with it. Again, you want to follow along with Joe, go check out the Exploration Insights website, which I will link to in the posting. And Joe, we'll chat again next month. Thank you so much for joining us on this weekend show.
Great. Thanks a lot, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.